Hosts Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is frequent visitor Arnold Snyder. Arnold is one of the great blackjack authors of all time, in addition to writing about poker, Sudoku, and topless Las Vegas. Arnold Snyder, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
How you doing, Bob? Hi, Richard.
Good to have you here, Arnold.
For tonight's show, Munchkin posted on Facebook and elsewhere asking people to send in questions for Arnold. And we've had great response, and we thank you for that. Before we get into the blackjack questions, since Arnold wrote about topless Las Vegas, there's been two things on that general subject happening in the last week. In Las Vegas, at the Palazzo, which is next door to the Venetian, they have this nightclub that gets a bit raunchy, and they're trying to take it out. And there's some court cases about that. Do you know anything about that, Arnold?
I know very little about it. I read it in the newspaper, and apparently it's not a strip club. It's a nightclub, and they have a stage show, and apparently there have been complaints from somebody that the stage show was too raunchy for a casino. So I have no idea.
Hard to imagine.
Sounds like Miley Cyrus. Now, in Atlantic City, they're supposed to be bringing in a strip club to the Taj Mahal.
That's right. Scores, which is one of the really big chains. They had a strip club here in Las Vegas, initially called Scores. It later became Rick's. And then it became Scores again. It went through about five names in about 6 years. And right now, it is no longer a strip club. I heard they were turning it into a regular nightclub or something at some point. And again, I haven't been in Atlantic City for years. This is the first time I know of a strip club actually opening inside a casino. The newspaper article I read said that, it won't really be a strip club. It will have apparently dancers on stage, but they're not. It said we'll have lap dancing, but there will be no contact. And I don't know what they mean by that. You know, it probably has to do with casino rules. So who knows? I have no idea what that's going to turn into.
I think it'll, if it does well, though, I think it'll be a trend, and we'll start to see them opening up in lots of places.
Would there be different levels of comps you could get based on your level of play?
That would probably be a big question a lot of players will have. So.
Bringing back the old days of Vegas.
Okay, good. Now let's get to blackjack. You know something about that. Is there any quality literature, published or unpublished, about using ace strategies alone or to supplement a straight counting game to further the advantage?
I don't know, other than my book, the Blackjack Shuffle Tracker's Cookbook, I don't know of much that's been published on ace strategies, especially specifically how to predict aces or sequence aces to predict them. I don't know of anything that I'd recommend that's been published, unless Munchkin might have heard of some book that's come out fairly recently.
No, I mean, the only book that I'm aware of, other than the Shuffle Tracker's Cookbook, is that book by McDowell, which I have to admit, you in particular gave it such a bad review that I never really have bothered to read it. And actually, you're not the only one, but There were quite a number of people, knowledgeable people I know, that read it and just said it was really actually kind of dangerous for the player because it gave them bad ideas, not just...
Right. It really has some very, very wrong mathematics in there. He made a number of mistakes in the book. It surprised me that a second edition didn't come out with corrections, because I very specifically pointed out exactly and precisely the errors that he made. The method that he was advising, that he was claiming had a pretty strong advantage for the player, really didn't have. It really didn't have any advantage for the player at all. It might have raised the player's, some tenth of a percent or something over what the house edge was, but there was no way that the method that he used and the mathematics he put in there was going to do anything to help anybody. I would think it's a dangerous book. Like I say, that one I know about, but I wouldn't recommend it to anyone.
You know, Jim Kilby, who teaches at UNLV, has a book on casino management. And when he first wrote that book, before it was ever published, he would distribute Xerox copies of the book to his class. And I have a copy from back in the 80s. And he included in that early copy a team manual from an ace sequencing team that was, busted by one of the casinos in Vegas. And they basically stole the team manual. And I guess Kilby got a part of it, got his hands on it, and included it in that early version of his book. But I guess when he finally published the book, he probably thought there might be some legal issues with him publishing it. So it's no longer there. So, but if people can dig up that very early Kilby casino management book, they can find that team manual from that ace tracking team.
Right. I can tell you that team manual came from Tommy Hyland's team, because that was something that I found at the court trial in Windsor back in, I don't know what that was, 12, 15 years ago. Where he had members of his ace sequencing team were busted, and there was a trial, and I was an expert witness in that trial. And I've seen that Kilby stuff, and I believe that's the same material that I saw in Windsor that was information that Tommy had put out for his teams. So it's accurate information, but it's not the type of thing anybody can pick up and look at that and read that and say, oh, now I know how to sequence aces. Now I can go make money doing this in casinos. It was a manual that had information and instructions for players, but it didn't really put everything in there that you needed to know and that you needed to do in order to do it. So, it has a limited value.
And what do you think about, this is a topic that comes up quite often. Players ask, should I learn to sequence aces and should I learn to shuffle track? What are your feelings about that with the state of the current shuffles today?
The shuffles are difficult. There are still a number of good shuffles in Las Vegas, a number of decent shuffles, so even a few one-pass shuffles. But shuffle tracking is extremely difficult, and the possibilities of doing it anywhere are very limited. Again, we did shuffle tracking in the Midwest and all over. And I haven't traveled through the country, through all the Indian casinos and riverboat casinos. And there were some decent shuffles all over the place. But, I haven't looked at those in about 10 years. I haven't gone into those places. In Las Vegas, there's so many machines on the games now. The shuffles are much more difficult than they used to be even 10 years ago. I mean, if you talk about 15 years ago, there were a lot of just wonderful shuffles available. But as far as ace sequencing, I don't think it's a wise thing for anybody to pay much attention to. And the reason is it looks so unusual to a casino, because the best way to take advantage of it is to bet small, bet small, bet small, bet small, and then suddenly bet like, you know, three hands of the, you know, the top bet, whatever your top bet is, so that, you know, say if you were let's say you were able to spread from 5 to 500, you would want to sit there betting $5 chips, and then every once in a while you'd suddenly throw out like three bets of 500, and then you'd go immediately back to your $5 chips. Now that would be the strongest way to play it. And as soon as you start putting more camouflage in there, where you're really taking away the value of a whole lot of the value of A sequencing, especially if that's your only the only strategy you're really using. There might be some conceivable value to it for card counters who are able to follow short sequences of cards before the ace and have some idea of where they will look for their sequence. And I've known a lot of players that have done things like this and have found some value to it. But for the average player, this type of thing, I just don't think it has a whole lot of value.
I think both shuffle tracking and sequencing can get players into a lot of trouble, because I think there are very, very few shuffles that are worth attacking. And but once they learn or think they've learned a skill, you know, to a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail, and they go out and try to apply the skill to shuffles they really shouldn't be trying to apply them to, and they end up losing money or playing where they really have no edge but think they do.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%, because we tried training players to track shuffles, and even on shuffles that I would consider, well, this is a very good, easily trackable shuffle, they're extremely difficult. It takes so much time and dedication, so much more than, say, something like card counting. You have to spend so much time just, you know, visually measuring cuts and the size of slugs and things like this to build up a level of accuracy at this type of thing. So I don't think there's a whole lot of value for most players to doing those kinds of strategies.
This same reader actually asked, what is the difference between ace sequencing, ace tracking, and ace prediction?
Well, I don't know. I think I would probably consider them all pretty much to be referring to the same thing. Maybe there's some way of predicting aces without using a sequencing method. You know, possibly just, you know, spotting it on the bottom card and trying to steer it or something like that. But for the most part, I think anybody that's talking about ace prediction or ace tracking or ace sequencing or ace steering, they're usually talking about sequencing, which is you're looking at a couple of cards that go into the discard rack that are going to come out right before the ace, and then you try to watch, and then you're hoping for a shuffle that is rather consistent, and that you're going to see these sequence cards in order a certain distance apart depending on the shuffle, and that you're going to then be able to put some big bets down to hit the ace. And that's the only way that, say, that I would say 99% of ace prediction, that's, I believe, is some method done like that.
Is double deck in Vegas a playable game today?
Boy, I'm not real familiar with what's happening in the double deck games. I know the single deck games, there's so many of them, are 6-5 on blackjack. And I'm not sure if they're doing that to the double decks. I've seen it even on shoe games. I would think anybody who's interested in looking for the conditions in Vegas probably ought to look into Stanford Wong's CBJN Casino Blackjack newsletter that continues to update the casino conditions and the number of tables and the shuffle points and the rules and things like that. Those types of things change so often that I think it's the kind of thing that, you know, asking me that, you know, if I haven't even been out there in 6 months, it's a waste of time for me trying to even recommend something.
You know, I would just say that for the higher stakes players, they tend to avoid the double decks because they tend to be counter traps. So the major strip casinos all offer double decks, but they watch them very closely. And I think for higher stakes players, they'd be much better off, you know, going after the shoe games. You know, for the lower stakes players, you can play the station casinos and the coast casinos, but, you know, those double decks, even there, you know, they tend to sweat even the nickel players.
It's much easier for the casino to spot card counters in the single and double deck games because your bets are going to be going up and down much more frequently as the counts go up and down much more frequently. And that is one of the reasons that the big money players tend to avoid single and double deck games. It's hard to disguise a card counting strategy in a game like that.
Since you mentioned Stanford Wong, there is this school in Las Vegas called Wong Yu, W-O-N-G-U. Apparently they teach Oriental medicine of some sort. Now, do you anticipate a Snyder Yu school here in Vegas just to keep up with a fellow blackjack guru?
Boy, I don't know. But if somebody starts it, I might go attend the classes.
Now, you've been promising a blackjack book for a long time.
Yeah.
Any update on that?
No. I know that's one of the reasons you asked me to come in here and talk. But that book is, there's a good portion of that book is written. A lot of computer simulations have been run to figure some things out that I don't think have been figured out before. Or if they have, they probably have, but they haven't been published before. Some of it has to do with things I'm not sure I want to disclose right now, and some of it just has to do with me being lazy and not getting off my ass and figuring out exactly what all I do want in that book. The book was announced way too early. I can tell you this, the reason that book was announced, and I think it's like 2 or 3 years ago now it was announced, my publisher wanted to do a sort of a version of a book I published way back in, maybe 1990 or something like that, called Blackjack Wisdom. And it was a compilation of a lot of articles I had written for Card Player and Casino Player and Gambling Times and all the different publications that were publishing blackjack articles back then. And what I thought I was going to do was take some of the best of that stuff and then mix it with some new stuff and put it together, and that wasn't going to take very long, and we were just going to get it out there. And then I decided against it because I just thought, you know what, I just didn't like the idea of publishing a bunch of old stuff. And I wanted to do something that was actually, you know, all new stuff and stuff that would have more value and more interest, even just more entertainment value. And so the whole project changed, and I started rewriting and turning it into a new book that had never, you know, I hadn't written before, and not using any old material. But that's why the book was announced way back. It was going to be a sort of a compilation, probably stuff that appeared in Blackjack Forum and all this. And I just decided I didn't want a book of old stuff coming out. I felt like, if I'm going to put out a book, it should be new. And so the problem was it was announced way too early. And people have sent me emails and messaged me and, you know, where is it? When's it coming? And, It's up in the air right now. All of a sudden, you know, you'll hear about it. Everybody will hear about it at the same time, I guess. I don't have a date, though.
So one of our listeners asks, do you consider yourself retired as an AP, or are you still out there playing?
I do not. I don't know if it's possible. I thought I retired years ago, but since then I've played numerous times in different types of games and situations that have come up. I don't know if it's possible to retire if you've really ever made any amount of money gambling and you found you can do it. It's hard not to see an opportunity, and there's a certain fun factor to looking for opportunities. I probably enjoy looking and analyzing opportunities, you know, as much or more than actually playing, depending on what the game is. But I don't know if it's possible to retire. I think I've continued to find weird things here and there that I'm willing to go put my money on. I haven't played a lot of blackjack, but you know, I've been playing other things here and there, off and on, you know, when I see something. And so, yeah, I don't know that I'll ever retire.
Have you been playing much poker?
I haven't been playing poker. I've done some online poker play at the new poker site at, that was opened by the Station Casinos. And it's pretty small right now. Everything there is like sort of like in the beginning, the especially if you compare it to the poker games that were available at Full Tilt and Party Poker and things like that. You know, like if they have a tournament, they're a lot of their tournaments, you know, very few have 100 players. A lot of them, you know, they're doing a lot of small sit and goes and things like that. So I've been fooling around in there just because it's there and it's easy and it's actually legal now. You know, there's no problem with people, you know, playing poker in there. But I haven't played poker. I didn't play any of the WSOP events this year, and I haven't played in. I haven't been playing in tournaments. I'm very tempted to get out there and just start playing in the small Las Vegas tournaments again, almost just for the enjoyment, because I live here and they're there, and you know, the buy-ins are small, and there's a certain fun factor to playing tournaments that I always liked. I think I've just been like too busy to get back into it.
You've had a number of blackjack teams through the years. When you had the teams, what kind of count systems did they use? Did they use high up one or high low? Or
I have personally, after I got into shuffle tracking, which was a lot of years ago, I started using the high low count, and then eventually went to the high-low light, which is really, it's just the high-low count, but it uses a count per half deck and a very simplified set of index numbers that I just found more convenient, a lot easier to use and apply and teach to other people. I tried putting a shuffle tracking team together it's like about 10 years ago, and that was using the high-low light. That is what I would use now. If I were to go sit at a blackjack table, that would be what I would use. I, you know, the count is extremely simple to use. I don't remember the index numbers off the top of my head anymore, but I could probably look at the page in Black Belt and Blackjack, and I'd have them all remembered within, you know, half an hour. You know, but I've always believed in simplicity. And I like that high-low system. I just think it's very practical and easy, and especially for something like shuffle tracking, I just think it's ideal.
Is there anything, looking back over your gambling, is there anything you would have done differently?
Oh, boy. Now, you see, this is a question you should have sent me in the mail.
Oh, I thought it was in that list.
Anything I would... Oh, I see it here.
Yes,
it is here.
You should read your mail, Arnold.
My question would be, looking back, is there anything you would have done different? Oh, okay. Okay, let's see. What would I have done different? I'm not sure that there's a lot I would have done different other than the fact that, you know, you learn things later. You learn things later that would have been helpful. I wish I would have had a greater grasp of, say, a lot of the statistics and things like that with regards to shuffle tracking. I wish I would have had, just certain things that I think in the course of playing where I discovered things that I really hadn't been doing ideally or correctly, you know, and they're very technical things. They're not the types of things that, you know, that would make any sense for me to say, you know, well, I wish I would have realized I was wasting my time when I, you know, For example, I mean, initially counting cards, I initially learned like 150 index numbers, I think like everybody did. And I was using a level 2 counting system. In other words, I really didn't start out with simplicity, you know, and I was side counting aces and side counting other cards. I was really making things much more difficult on myself when I started out. I eventually got down to much more simplicity. And that was true in shuffle tracking also. I initially was trying to track too much information and too many areas of the deck, rather than just trying to go for one or possibly two good strong slugs. And I think what I found out later was that if that's really all you're looking for, your chances of getting it right are so much better, rather than trying to have a count on the whole deck and now it's going into the low section, now it's going back to the high card section. Like, I used to think I was doing that stuff, and it's very complex, and I think I wasted a lot of time trying to do things that were more difficult than they had to be.
What about you, Bob? You've been gambling a long time. Would you have done anything differently?
I wish you had sent me this question in the mail before you asked it on the air.
Well, while you're thinking about it, I can give you my answer.
Let's hear your answer on that one.
And the one thing I wish I had done differently was I think I really took for granted the opportunities I had, and I wish that I had worked harder back when I was single and had no kids. And, you know, back in the 80s, whole card games, like if it wasn't 100%, we didn't even bother playing it because they were so plentiful. And again, as I say, I just took them for granted, and I wish I had really sort of put in a lot more time and made a lot more money when I had those opportunities.
Back when I was playing backgammon in the 70s, I was holding my own, but also into the party scene, and they used marijuana was freely available and other things. And so I would partake and gamble while high. And I haven't had any marijuana since, I guess, think 82 or 83, something like that. But I'm surprised at the things that I willingly gave up edge just for a short term kind of a feel good thing.
Now, did you feel when you were doing that, did you feel you were playing less than your best game?
Oh, 100%, yes. But enjoying it more. Oh yeah, I would, and you just roll double fives, and oh, they look beautiful, and so sometimes I would follow things down and just lose my track. And anyway, nothing really that abnormal for people who had done drugs, but it was so after hours, there was a lot of that, and so it's like, my thought is, oh, free grass, this is good. And of course the host would offer it and not partake any, and he ended up winning quite a bit. So now I don't drink and I don't do that, which is, and my results are better. Now, back when you had teams,
yeah,
how did you, if somebody came up to you and said, I'd like to be a member of your team, how would you qualify him? How would you vet him?
Okay, technically, I think I've really only, well, I've been involved with a number of teams. Let's see. When I had the shuffle tracking team, I first of all, you have to realize that, you know, because of my writing and the magazine and everything, I just knew hundreds of players that I'd had correspondence with, and I mean, so many experts on the subject and authors that it wasn't difficult for me to look for people that I already had a pretty good feeling about.
But you knew hundreds, but thousands knew who you were.
Yeah, well, that's probably true. But the thing is, It's one of the things when I was writing, when I had my magazine, I don't even know how many letters I would get. I would get a number of letters every month. Just people asking, you know, I'm looking for a team to join or whatever. I can do this. I'm willing to train. I mean, I had so many people that were contacting me specifically about, you know, trying to get to meet other players. I was always very cautious because I always considered these could be surveillance people trying to find things out, trying to look for teams, trying to find out anything. So I was always very cautious. But the thing is it's sort of like if you're having a, you know, if you have a 4 or 5 year correspondence with somebody about the you know, analysis of blackjack or you know, anything like that, anything to do with blackjack, and you meet people, you have dinner with them sometimes, they come to Vegas, you meet them in Vegas or you meet them in Reno, and you know, I just knew so many people that it wasn't hard for me to look for people that I already knew something about. The shuffle tracking team, there were a number of players that I hadn't met that I didn't know anything about. But they were people that were, say, very highly recommended by other people that I knew. It's not like I, you know, I had a problem going out and trying to find, you know, a dozen people that wanted to do something like that. I had a list of people that I felt like, you know, I should talk to this person, talk to that person. And, you know, so I think trying to put a team together, I think for an average person, if you're going to try to put a team together, do it with your best friends or do it with the friends that you currently talk about gambling with. Do it with the people that you know that share the, you know, your attitudes about it and your feelings about it, and, you know, people that you actually trust. There are so many stories out there of people that have gotten together with you know, with teammates who ended up ripping them off, or that they ended up being accused of ripping them off, and you know, that type of stuff is so common that, you know, I think people have to be very careful. I don't think it's easy to go out and form a team.
Yeah, I agree. There are a lot of pitfalls that are easy to fall into in putting teams together. And actually, one of them that I think some night we should have a roundtable discussion, bring in Tommy Hyland and, you know, John Chang and various guys, and just talk about how to properly structure a bankroll, because that is one of the big, really big problems. I mean, stealing aside, just the issues of how do you compensate the players so that they don't lose interest when the bankroll starts losing, and you know, and still make it fair to the investors, and it's a complicated thing.
Yeah, I think probably the most workable system is for two players that know each other and get along and trust each other's skills and can test each other and can, great, they can put their bankrolls together and have a two-man team. And if they can meet a third one, hey, then you can draw it into a three-man team. I would say start very slow if this is something that interests you. Start with one other person and build it as you go. I wouldn't advise people to try, you know, putting together a dozen players to be a team, especially if you're talking about, you know, substantial amounts of money, which you would be if you had that many players. You know, you might have hundreds of thousands of dollars very easily. And, you know, you have to trust people. You have to trust people to you know, put the money in their pockets and buy the chips and play and accurately report the results of the play. And, you know, as soon as there's any kind of mistrust at all, you know, it really kind of sours the whole team experience.
Yeah, I've you know, played on big teams and small, and I'm much happier playing small with a few, very few people, you know. And for me, I also don't like the long-term commitment, you know.
But somehow you've been married for 25 years.
Well, I'm talking about a gambling commitment. You know what I mean? Yeah, my marriage is a commitment. But no, with gambling, you know, the way I play now is, you know, I go play for two or three of us go somewhere for 3 or 4 days. And at the end of it, we chop up the money and that's it. You know, there's
that's the way it works best is, you know, like I say, do it with your friends. Do it. If you only have one friend that's in, do it with that one friend. If there's two, three or four of you, yeah, you can put together a team. You trust each other. You've known each other for years. And, you know, if you trust each other's skill levels and you all know what you're doing, that's the way that it works, you know. And that's the way that I think it works best and would work best for most people. I don't think the big – I mean, you know, maybe I'm out of the loop. But, you know, I mean, there was a time in the 80s and up into the 90s where the Highland team and the MIT team and the Czech team and the you know, the Greek team, you know, these were really big teams, you know, dozens of players on these teams and real a lot of money behind them. I don't think those kind of ventures are happening right now, or if they are, it's not on the scale that it used to be on.
Part of that is the casinos have figured out they kind of burned out the whole big player concept.
Yeah, the big player and the ace sequencing, you know, the types of things that the teams were doing and getting away with was, you know, it's you can't get away with that much anymore.
Yeah.
Somebody sent us an email about gambling on a casino boat. And let me read it. It said, there's a casino boat that will announce three hands left in blackjack as the boat is about to come back into U.S. waters. What they really means is three rounds left. Three hands are dealt to the dealer. The table limits are $25 to $500. I normally use a betting unit of $100, but if I assume my net worth is my bankroll, then my betting unit should be higher, probably around $250. Anyway,
right there, I would say stop. I would not ever assume your net worth is your bankroll. That's really getting kind of crazy. But go ahead.
Occasionally, the count on the boat will get high enough that I'll spread to two or three, depending on the number of other players' hands, of several hundred dollars each. When the announcement is made that there are only three hands left, should I spread to three hands? Three hands is the max I let you, of 500 each, if I have any advantage at all due to the count. There is no heat in this situation because they assume that you came to gamble and this is your last opportunity as the table's about to be shut down. Also assume you're not worried about if you go over the $10,000 total buy-in.
All right. Okay, well, first let me say, okay, if you're 21 years old, you're not married, you have no kids, well, then maybe you can assume your net worth is your bankroll if you have some way to put another bankroll together. But as soon as you say, what is your bankroll, you're talking about the amount of money you can afford to lose. And not many people can afford to lose their net worth. I mean, that literally means everything that you own. So that is kind of a crazy way to look at it. I don't understand why, when there's three hands left with any advantage, he'd want to suddenly spread to three hands of 500. It's like, well, yeah, first of all, it's true that you will have the greatest dollar return on those three hands. But I don't think that in the long run, it's going to be worth it to you to even get that much fluctuation. You're risking money at a rate that is higher than you should be risking it. You know, if you're betting full Kelly, if anybody understands what that means, that would mean like with a 1% advantage, you'd be betting about 1%, actually slightly less, of your bankroll. Now any advantage, I mean, you could have a 1/10% advantage. You know, I wouldn't want to risk anything on a 1/10% advantage. It's, you know, I understand there are players out there doing that because that's the biggest advantage they can get. But on a game that has a lot of fluctuation and a very high risk of ruin, suddenly, you know, spreading to three hands of 500, you're almost going to say that the value of your whole trip is going to have to do with what happens on these last three hands. You know, I just think that's, you know, if you can play three hands of 500 each, so you can have 1,500 for three rounds, you're putting $4,500 in action, and you're typically using a $100 unit, To me, it just doesn't make sense at all. I would not advise somebody to do that. What do you think, Munchkin? Is there any sense to doing something like that?
Yeah, it seems to me that the time limit thing is just a confuser. You know, the question is, what are you comfortable betting? What is your betting unit? And just because somebody announces, okay, the next three hands you can bet heat free, does that mean you should suddenly, you know, bet more than what you're comfortable with your betting unit being? You know, so yeah, I mean, I think you should decide what you're comfortable betting in terms of a unit and stay with it.
Yeah. There's no practical reason to suddenly be betting huge there other than the fact that, okay, there's no heat, therefore I can get away with it. But it's like, well, you know, I can go
place. But then why aren't you betting that unit the whole time?
Yeah, you could walk in and bet that right off the top. Hey, that's heat free.
Yeah. Well, except that's the maximum, and so you can't increase the bet.
Yeah.
So it sounds like he could have a higher. He said he could have $250 units, but
That's really the question. If you have the bankroll to have a higher unit, why are you not playing the higher unit to start with?
Well, I read it as he doesn't have the bankroll because he says if he uses his net worth as his bankroll, his unit would be 250. I think that $100 unit is probably about as far as he wants to go, and I think he ought to stick to just.
But if it's a true six, you can bet 500 with a $100 unit. Yeah, so
Well, that's true, but I'm assuming he would do that. I mean, what he said is, should I bet, you know, three hands of 500 for the last three hands if I have any advantage at all? You know, well, no, I think you should bet that if the count justified it, meaning your advantage over the house justified it. But otherwise, you're just looking at incredible fluctuation on the last three rounds.
Right. Now, there was another kind of weird question, too. And this one was, I don't see it in front of me, but the basic idea was the guy is a basic strategy player, but they have really good penetration. So he's wondering if he should bet more late in the shoe because of the good penetration, even though he's not counting cards.
Yeah, I saw that, and the answer is no. Do not just bet more because it's deep in the shoe. It could be horrible. It could be really great, or it could be really horrible. And so if you don't have any handle at all on what the, you know, what the edge is or, you know, what the count is, no, it just the penetration alone is meaningless. I see another one here. I am looking at the email here. One question came in. Why does Zen, he's talking about the Zen count, not have a surrender index for 17 versus ace? Right. In my book, I don't think I have any surrender indexes for 17. It would be a very high index number. There's extremely little value to it. I think, I believe with like the high-low count, if you look in Stanford Wong's, the high-low count for 17 versus ace, and he's using count per deck, I think his count is up around 10, 11, 12, something like that. With the Zen count, which is a level 2 count, if you were using a count per deck, it would probably be up someplace between 20 to 25, which would be the true count. So it's an extremely rare index number that you'd be using. Now, I used Zen count, the way I put it in my book, not the way I played it, the way that I put it in my book was with a count per quarter deck, which would mean your index number would probably be down somewhere around 5 or 6. But still, that is an extremely unusual, you know, high count for a quarter deck. I did have a surrender index for the high-low light when I was shuffle tracking, because we would see some extreme counts. And I believe, now I was using count per half deck with the high-low light, and I believe my index number was like 5 or 6 or something like that. But it's a very rare play. You're not going to see a count that high, and the overall value of it would be almost more for camouflage, just because it looks weird to surrender a 17. you know.
Well,
and
actually, I mean, if the dealer hits soft 17, then surrendering 17 versus an ace wouldn't be high at all. But I mean, at the time you wrote the book, most places were stand 17.
I don't know. Does it change that much for hits off 17?
Actually, I think 17 versus an ace is a basic strategy surrender for hits off 17.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
I may really embarrass
played in hits off 17 games. You know, when I was tracking shuffles, the places that I was playing stood on Saw 17. Most of them were the big casinos here in Vegas and Atlantic City.
Yeah, even so. They've changed nowadays, but yeah
right.
The rules have changed over the years.
This has been very interesting. And I haven't played blackjack in years, and I'm learning stuff, so thank you. We have a couple of questions left, so after we do some commercials, don't go away. We're going to hit you with some more. You might want to read them first. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anyone else. In September, there will be a swipe and win events Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Play 200 points, and swipe, and earn prizes ranging from 2,500 points, or $7.50, to $50 in free play. Generally speaking, if you get big mailers, the biggest is $75 a week there. You have a good chance for the high prizes, which is $50 of free play. If you get small mailers or no mailers, you tend to get the 2,500 points or maybe a free lunch or breakfast buffet. To be the most valuable prize is 2x points, but it expires at midnight the night you receive it. So plan accordingly if that prize is of value to you. They have hot seat Sundays from noon to 9 p.m. where $500 is awarded every 15 minutes. Double points for video poker will take place Labor Day this coming Monday, midnight to midnight, no limits. You'll find me on Quick Quads. The free video poker classes will begin September 10th at noon in the showroom. That's less than 2 weeks. The first class will be Jacks or Better. At the Palms, this weekend is the last one of their $125,000 big deal drawings. Beginning at 8 p.m. Saturday, you'll begin earning tickets into the $102,000 Great Gridiron giveaway, which will be the promotion during September. Top prizes Friday and Saturday evenings at 8 p.m. will be $8,000. We'll have more details on the drawing next week. 8 p.m. to midnight Friday and Saturday. They continue to award 5x drawing entries. PEW, Play, Earn, and Win, for the first half of the month has the theme of Chow Chow. That's not a dog. The first Chow is spelled C-I-A-O as an Italian word for goodbye or something like that. The prizes you win are cookware and gift certificate to Familia Pizza and the Nove Italian restaurant. For the second half of the month, the theme is Pack Your Bags, where the prizes will be suitcases and other travel paraphernalia. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, the monthly mailer says you can redeem your points for gas cards. The card they have describing it says you don't have to redeem your points. You get to keep your points. But they don't have the amounts in the description. Typically, when they have gas cards, it requires 40,000 video poker points to get a $100 gas card, which is 0.25%, which is equivalent to double points. So if you are a video poker player, then and they keep that rate, this will be double points Tuesdays and Thursdays. When you earn your Tuesday points, carry over to Thursday when they expire. You either use them by Thursday or lose them. At videopoker.com, the August contest, which will go through Saturday night, is Triple Play Dream Card. First prize is a $1,000 gift card, a Visa gift card. The smartest game to play by far is Triple Double Bonus, where you get the 4,000 coins for either a royal or four aces with a kicker. Being dealt two royals or two sets of aces with a kicker in 100 hands will put you in the running. You'll be about fourth place now if you get that. Anything short of that doesn't give you a chance to win. It's not quite as hard as it seems. Dream Card is a game where periodically the fifth card is a dream card and gives you the best card to fill in the hand. So it's a lot easier to get dealt royals. It's a lot easier to get four aces with a kicker than it is in regular video poker, but it still isn't easy. VideoPoker.com is helping to sponsor the free video poker classes at the South Point. Each person who attends at least one class earns a certificate good for 1 month free gold membership on the VideoPoker.com website. The gold membership allows you to practice some games that haven't been released yet and other games that have been released but aren't available to practice on for their other players. In addition, when you're on your site, if you have the gold membership, you don't see a lot of the ads. It's one per person. Whether this is one per person per semester or one per person per lifetime, we'll have to see. Our guest next week is Bill Roberti. I knew Bill Roberti when I was a backgammon player back in the late 80s, early 90s. I began becoming familiar with his work. He also has helped Dan Harrington write some excellent poker books. What else do you know about him, Munchkin?
Well, that's it. You know, backgammon and poker. Some of the best poker books out there, the Dan Harrington books. Bill wrote. He's also written a lot of really good backgammon books. So looking forward to that.
Good. I'm looking
forward. You've read the Harrington books, haven't you, Arnold?
Yes, I have.
Very good. All right. So Arnold hasn't gone away. That means we get to ask him more questions. When you said you might go back to playing poker in some of these small tournaments. So your poker book, Poker Formula, addressed a strategy that you use playing those particular kind of tournaments, I don't know, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, something like that.
Yeah.
Would you guess that same strategy would work today, or you think you're going to need to develop a whole new strategy if you start playing those again?
It'll be interesting to see. I believe the games today, that even the small tournaments, I suspect they'd be a lot more aggressive. I think you'll find more aggressive players there and more players who are willing to take risks. Tournaments are a lot easier if you're playing with players who are more passive, who are waiting for cards, who are not taking risks, who are bluffing less. I suspect that even in the small tournaments, you're going to find a lot more of that kind of play because so much of that kind of play has been televised. People just learn to, you know, love Gus Hansen and all the crazy plays that they saw people making with crazy cards. And I think that kind of play has become popular. And I think this would make tournaments a lot more difficult, poker tournaments. But that's one of the reasons I think it would be fun to go in and just see what they're like, see what the games are like, what the players are like now. It was like in 2005, 2006 when I was playing those games.
Well, I read your Poker Formula, and it was the best single book for me because I was a beginner and playing in some of these beginner tournaments, and it was eye-opening. It was a whole, some of the others were more confusing. That one was very good. We got 10 seconds left. Thank you, Arnold, for being here. Thank you, Munchkin. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.